Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein, and I'd like to welcome back one of our great guest co-hosts, Carol Ripley Moffitt. Welcome, Carol.
Thank you, Adam.
On our show today, we will have a chance to hear a recent interview that we did with Dr. Victor Garcia and Dr. Jenna Honeycutt, professor of medicine and postdoctoral research at the Center for AIDS Research and the UNC School of Medicine, about cutting edge of HIV research.
An important topic for us to explore.
Yeah, and the progress and some of the remaining challenges. Really looking forward to that conversation. But first, we also have some interesting research that matters. What's our very first research that matters, Carol?
The first article is a study by our own UNC School of Medicine and NIH scientist, learning that the saturated fats from butter, which we were told for a healthy heart we needed to replace with corn oil or other vegetable oils, may have not been the best advice after all. The British Medical Journal published this research showing that those who had replaced the butter with the linoleic acid oils, such as corn oil, cottonseed oil, safflower oil, actually, even though they decreased their cholesterol, they increased their risk of dying from heart disease.
Yeah, this is like one of those health research methods or reports that you kind of go, oh, you know, you think you knew something and then you heard differently.
Yeah.
And we had heard for a while now, I think, that the story on butter is a little bit more complicated than just kind of cholesterol-based. And they went back and looked at some of the largest of the trials, the Minnesota Coronary Experiment, that was originally done between 1968 and 1973 with almost 10,000 patients, that really did show that these saturated fats and cholesterol were lower when they switched to corn oil from butter. But they never really showed that it decreased mortality or coronary heart attack deaths. And so these researchers not only went back and tried to recover this original data and look at it in follow-up, but they also published a systematic review where they really looked at different data in different percent of studies, and basically showed in neither of these analyses did they really find differences here. So it doesn't mean necessarily that there is an increased risk from doing it, but certainly they can believe they can say with much more confidence it ain't a benefit either.
Right. So does that mean we all stick with olive oil?
I think it means that, at least in my way of understanding, and you can tell me what you think, Carol, that it's a little bit of butter, if one is using it for flavoring, is probably okay. A little bit of corn oil is probably okay. Probably olive oil, what I use mm-hmm. for more cooking, or even sometimes not using oil for cooking and looking to steam foods and other ways of cooking that may not really have any downsides.
I think it's always important to make sure your whatever oil you're using is fresh and you smell it and make sure it doesn't smell rancid at all. That's an important thing to be aware of as well.
And we want to congratulate our colleagues at the UNC School of Medicine Department of Psychiatry for doing some really important secondary data analysis and research. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about our very next research that matters, which is about a difficult issue that I'm certain, Carol, in your work actually counseling people about behavior change, you come across, which is
definitely
post-traumatic stress disorder. You've seen
this
before.
Yes, definitely, and how difficult it is. I mean, all the time new studies are coming out about methods that can help people deal with an event in their past that just seems to continue to haunt them.
Our listeners may not know that you have tremendous expertise in training in pastoral care and divinity. And so, again, I'm sure through that experience you also encounter folks who have had significant trauma that leads to post-traumatic stress disorder.
Exactly.
And so what sort of treatments would you normally – you've heard and that you see and that you probably have participated in?
One of my recent patients told me that that talk therapy is not always very helpful, that something that's more experiential could be more helpful. Somatic experiences were what this patient thought could actually help him get past some of the feelings that he had and some of the ways in which his PTSD was blocking his quality of life.
And another way that's frequently done is using medication with these SSRIs, or selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor medications. Mm-hmm. And in this particular study, which was published in the Journal of Clinical Psychiatry, there were a total of 232 individuals over 12 weeks who were kind of followed after a traumatic event. And they included those who were put into these different types of treatments, like prolonged exposure therapy, experiential cognitive therapy, treatment with medications, or those who declined treatment, and they were followed up at 5 and 36 months. And they basically found that those who got therapy, including those who got medication, were better quicker. But at the end of 3 years, they were very similar to those who kind of declined treatment. Like two-thirds kind of got better. But then there's this group of one-third who didn't get better quickly with the medication and the treatments, and who declined treatment, who also didn't get better. There's a resistant group here. So two take-home messages: if you get treatment, you get better quicker. And if you're not responding to treatment, you may have really need for much more intensive therapy.
Intensive behavioral therapy, but also looking at there may have to be some alternatives to combine with that traditional therapy.
Yeah, we need more research here.
And more research,
in particular.
Definitely.
Absolutely.
Yes.
But we encourage to get some treatment. And lastly, this last research that matters is about gambling. And this is research that was published in the journal Neuropsychopharmacology. Now, that is a difficult full name, but it really describes this sort of research, which looks at compulsive gambling and what happens when gamblers either don't win or lose, but maybe they get close to winning.
Exactly. This was a study from the Netherlands, and the area of the brain called the striatum would be more active when people who gambled compulsively had these near misses, more so than people who were not used to gambling all the time or who had a problem with their gambling. And whether this is because it gave them a little bit more sense of control that they almost won, not sure, but that maybe it did increase their likelihood to
continue gambling.
This
is like, you know, a lot of things. You could see people playing the lottery. They keep playing the lottery because
I almost got it.
I got you know, three out of the five, six numbers where the likelihood of getting all six numbers was really one in a, you know, a couple hundred million. But there's this element here that's I think helpful for us as clinicians in order to counsel patients. And probably important message out there that if one has addiction, if including gambling, cues to that are really just as important as the behavior itself. And I think the advertising and marketing that we know works in getting people to use tobacco products and alcohol products could be an important cue for gambling.
And the surprise in this study was that it was not related to dopamine release, which is often associated with addiction and with that pleasure reward center of the brain.
Well, that'll conclude the research that matters. We're going to take a short break, but when we return, we'll be having an interview with Dr. Victor Garcia and Dr. Jenna Honeycutt, professor of medicine and postdoctoral researcher at the Center for AIDS Research in the UNC School of Medicine, at the cutting edge of HIV research. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Carol Ripley Moffitt. We'll be right back. UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Catherine Koh. Today on Conversations, Catherine, we get the great pleasure of talking with Dr. Victor Garcia and Dr. Jenna Honeycutt, professor of medicine and postdoctoral researcher at the Center for AIDS Research in the University of North Carolina School of Medicine, about the cutting edge of HIV research.
Welcome, Drs. Garcia and Honeycutt. We're so happy to have you guys here today.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here with you today.
You both work on the front lines of HIV research. Wondering if you wouldn't mind telling us and our listeners what got you interested in those career pathways.
So my interest in HIV research actually started when I got my first post-college graduate job. So I started as a clinical trials assistant at Duke, and there I was a clinical trials assistant. So there I started working with HIV-infected patients and recruiting them for various clinical trials, as well as doing rapid HIV testing in the emergency department. So that was where I got my first kind of interaction, an introduction into HIV and the different therapies for HIV. And so I think that really shaped where I chose to do my rotations once I entered graduate school, and probably ultimately led to me choosing a laboratory that works on HIV research, was that initial kind of patient connection early on to actually see it as a real disease and something that affects a plethora of people.
Well, we're so glad that you did. And what about you, Dr. Garcia?
I was minding my own business at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology doing some
We've heard of that. It's called like MIT.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
And I was doing something completely different when I got a phone call from someone in Seattle asking if I would like to join their efforts. They were going to start a new program on HIV and AIDS at the Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center there. And I told him, but I don't do anything on HIV. I don't know anything about it. And he said, well, don't either. So we'll all learn together here. So that's where we got started, by moving all across the country to Seattle and starting an HIV program from scratch.
And then what brought you to North Carolina?
The wonderful opportunity of being part of a great team of researchers that have dedicated their entire lives to the HIV and AIDS epidemic.
You know, it might seem unusual that North Carolina could be an epicenter of research on HIV care. And I must say, when I first came to North Carolina back around 1990, 1993, it would have been the last thing that I would have thought I would have been heavily involved in. But it turns out I think HIV affects a lot of people who we don't talk about as much. And at that point in time, I had a brother-in-law who was dying of HIV disease, who subsequently mm-hmm. did. And he died maybe a year before there were really the good drugs, that we had data mm-hmm. that these drugs were emerging that could save lives. I don't know if this is a personal issue for so many people.
I think that most of us have been touched by the epidemic very directly, by someone that we know closely. It has been a scourge of the 20th century, and UNC played a critical role during the early stages of the AIDS epidemic, because UNC was a center for excellence in hemophilia. And hemophilic patients used to receive blood transfusions mm-hmm. before we knew that the virus could be contaminating those samples. So they were thrown into the fire by the fact that they were trying to take care of those patients.
Now, it seems to me that the treatment for HIV has really just taken leaps and bounds ever since I first started learning about it, say in high school. Several years now later, it's completely different names that I have no idea what they're treating, what they mean. Wondering if you wouldn't mind kind of giving an overview summary of where we were, say, 10 years ago and where we are now, and how you foresee kind of the future of HIV treatment.
HIV treatment is being probably one of the greatest successes of medicine in this and last century. And says we went from HIV being a death sentence to being more of a chronic disease, where a pill a day will keep literally the doctor at bay. So it's just a wonderful testament to how when we all put our minds to something and we have the resources that are necessary to push something forward, literally miracles can happen, and we can bring people from the death.
We've made a large impact, that you say it's not a death sentence, it's like a chronic disease. Is that true around the world, or really, because I think at some levels we think, okay, we have great drugs, we just need to get them to everyone, but clearly you think that that's not enough. Otherwise, you wouldn't have gone into this research, Dr. Honeycutt, I imagine. Tell me about how, when you started coming in and doing your postdoctoral research and thinking about, you know, this can be a career for you, how do you understand what your niche is?
So I think kind of where I'm finding my niche now would be more in the HIV cure research. So while we have very good treatments, there are side effects. That's one where you can kind of pick and choose your side effects and kind of shop around for which therapies you tolerate well.
Like what? What do you mean?
So there are certain therapies that will cause a lot of gastrointestinal side effects. And so you kind of have to build up tolerance for a while until you can sort of maintain those without any ill effects. When I was still working on the clinical trials, I had a couple patients I was recruiting for studies who would have very vivid, strange dreams and stuff like that. So there can be some neurological effects. It just depends on the regimen you're on. That will determine essentially what your side effects are. And honestly, since you have to take medication every day, it's something that most people aren't really, you don't really want to. And this is one of those times where you really do have to take that every day. If you start skipping, then you become at risk for developing resistance to your current regimen.
So really wanting to say, we can control it, but the treatments where someone like me as a physician might say, God, I'm so glad we have a chronic pill, you're, as a researcher, saying that's not enough.
Yes. We're looking for the day where you don't have to take anything else, where it's a one-time treatment or a couple rounds of this type of therapy will then result in you not having to take any more drugs. We just monitor you over the next couple years.
How close do you think we are to that point?
Not close enough. Mm-hmm. I think that we still have a lot of unknowns that need to be revealed in a better understanding of what causes the virus to go dormant and disappear from our radar, our way of looking for it in the periphery of the patient, so that we can actually know when it's no longer there.
So we're going to get into and understand some specific research that you are doing and have done and published. And I guess I'd like to understand a little bit more about how do today's treatments really affect transmission? Are we talking about cutting transmission, or are we talking about once someone gets it, reducing the likelihood that it's going to impact on them?
Actually, that's probably one of the areas where UNC has excelled and where our colleagues at the school have made probably some of the most profound contributions to the field.
Like what? Can you give an example?
Treatment as prevention. That's exactly the name that it goes by. And in essence, what our colleagues at the division were able to demonstrate is that if patients adhere to their treatment, the virus disappears from the periphery in their secretions. And transmission is reduced over 90% just by the simple fact that the infected patient is taking their medicine. So it's an incredible breakthrough. So you can pretty much eliminate transmission if patients take their medicine. Now, there are some significant hurdles to implementing something like that. And the first one is that we don't know sometimes when people are first infected. And during acute infection is when patients are the most able to transmit the virus. So we're able to know when somebody is first infected and start treatment immediately. We could reduce transmission dramatically just by administering the same therapy they're going to take for controlling their virus.
Well, we're going to need to take a short break. When we return, let's dive into your research. And this is at a molecular level, at a mouse model level, at a level that I think people can really understand the value of perhaps investment in science. I'm really looking forward to this. But we will take a short break. But when we return, we'll continue talking with Dr. Victor Garcia and Dr. Jenna Honeycutt, professor of medicine and postdoctoral researcher at the Center for AIDS Research in the University of North Carolina School of Medicine, about the cutting edge of HIV research. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Catherine Koch.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Catherine Koch. We've been talking to Dr. Victor Garcia and Dr. Jenny Honeycutt, professor of medicine and postdoctoral researcher at the Center for AIDS Research in the UNC School of Medicine, about the cutting edge of HIV research. In our last segment, we spoke about both of your pathways towards research in HIV, and we were discussing how HIV is now more of a chronic disease rather than a death sentence, which shows how much the research and treatment has come, how far it's come. But one of the things that's limiting us from a cure is that you mentioned it gets taken out of the periphery by our treatments, but it's still not cured, and it's hiding somewhere. And Dr. Honeycutt, you've been doing some research recently and published a paper about this. Do you mind telling us where it might be hiding, and does this make it easier or more difficult for further treatments?
Sure. So in the recent publication, we were looking at HIV infection of macrophages. So in the immune system, you've got lots of different types of cells. So HIV primarily targets T cells. So it's a type of immune cell. They circulate around. So we've known for decades now that T cells are a target for infection.
Why are they targets for infection? Well, is it T for target?
No. So it's... So the T actually comes from where they originate. So these are cells that originate in the thymus. And so their T lymphocytes are kind of another name for them.
Lymphocytes that fight infection.
Yes.
Okay.
So these would be part of your adaptive immune system. So this is the more specific type of immune response that you can have. So we've known for years, we've demonstrated that T cells are easily infected by HIV, particularly the CD4-positive helper T cells, as they're called.
And those are the cells that really help fight infection. And if those cells are going down, we're much more likely our immune systems to get infection. Okay.
Yeah. And so that's essentially why HIV infection untreated would lead to acquired immune deficiency syndrome or AIDS. And it's because they're taking out one of those major immune populations over time. So what we were interested in doing here was looking at what happens in the absence of that. So it's been researched for several years now, what would be the role of macrophages in this? So HIV DNA and RNA has been found in macrophages for years and years. But there has been some recent studies that question whether or not the macrophages were actually truly infected.
What do macrophages do?
So macrophages are a different type of immune cell. So they're what is considered part of your innate immune system. So the name just literally means big eater. So they're a type of phagocytic cell that will just come in, eat cell products or debris or anything that doesn't look right. It doesn't look like a healthy, happy cell that is yours. So macrophages are different type of immune cell, but express some of the same surface receptors that allow HIV to enter T cells. So that's why they've been an area of interest for HIV research as well. But since they eat everything, it was kind of there were two papers in 2014 that were looking at whether or not we were inadvertently saying macrophages are infected, when in fact these were just eating infected T cells. So maybe the macrophages themselves weren't truly infected. So what we were able to do in our studies was we created a humanized mouse model that is reconstituted with human macrophages but lacks human T cells. So this allowed us the opportunity to look at HIV infection over time in a system that's completely devoid of T cells. So it allowed us to show that macrophages alone can sustain HIV infection over time in a living organism.
So without any T cells present, you were able to show that somehow the HIV virus still got into the macrophages without them necessarily having eaten bad cells.
Yes. And we can show that they were able to produce RNA and DNA. We were able to show that these cells can transmit infection as well by taking and purifying the macrophages and injecting them into HIV-naive humanized mice. So then we can show that the new mice got infected. So we show that these could potentially be a source of a cell-associated viral inoculum that could potentially infect new animals or be passed even between people.
I had never really heard of the macrophages being so important to the reservoir. Is this new or was I information? And it sounds like you really are directing targets. And I want to hear about these targets because you're talking about targeted killing of cells, which sounds good but a little frightening too. What about it, Dr. Garcia?
Well, I think that you have to know your enemy. And the importance of this study is that we have identified macrophages clearly as targets that need to be destroyed in order to eradicate the virus from the body. They can replicate the virus, and the question that remains to be addressed, that we hope to have some information on in the not-too-distant future, is whether or not macrophages represent a long-lived reservoir of the virus. Because the long-lived reservoir has been clearly established for T cells, and those infected cells that persist over years of treatment are the ones that are responsible for not being able to eradicate the virus from infected patients after therapy. So if macrophages represent another reservoir, then we need to develop technologies and approaches that would specifically destroy those cells as well as the infected T cells.
But we need macrophages, right? I mean, our body, I can't imagine we didn't have some of these big eaters eating the things that they need to normally eat. So how do you differentiate in your targeted therapies between killing all macrophages in your body, which I couldn't imagine could be a good thing for people?
Correct. We need to deliberately target the cells that are actually infected by the virus. And it's very tricky because in most cases, when patients are under treatment for extended periods of time, what happens is that the virus goes dormant. When the virus is dormant, you can't tell one cell from the other. So people have implemented, and are currently clinically testing strategies that will reawaken the virus. And the word kick the virus out of latency is being used around. So you kick the virus out of latency, but then now you're actually making more virus. So now you need to destroy those cells before you get into more trouble. And so by having therapy on board that prevents infection of new cells and inducing strategies that would destroy them, in essence, kill the infected cells, then you have a strategy where you wake the virus by kicking it out of latency, and then you destroy the cells by killing the infected cells. And that's a terminology that is being used as far as approaches to eradicate HIV, the kick and kill strategies for HIV eradication.
Now, how exactly do you get that two-pronged approach, both to kick and kill, like in one pill, for example? Like, how do you make sure that you have the killing mechanism present by the time you kick it?
Well, I think that that's actually where we are with today's research. In essence, we don't have anything that can potentially do both. We are exploring possibilities that include different types of drugs that can induce the virus, and then a different type of approach to actually kill the infected cells. Our hope is, like you say, to have a single approach that can be used for both purposes, but I think we're still away from that.
Well, you know, you both have referred to, you mentioned these humanized mouses. I can't let that go without hearing at least something about what is a humanized mouse. This is not just a mouse that acts like we see on TV. What's a humanized mouse?
A humanized mouse is what it sounds like, sort of in a nutshell. So it's a mouse that expresses basically various components of the human immune system. So this is done by taking immunodeficient mice. There are actually several strains of immunodeficient mice that support reconstitution, and essentially you will engraft these immunodeficient mice with either human cells and or tissues. And then because the recipient mouse doesn't really have its own immune system to fight off the new human cells will they'll expand and kind of reach the entire mouse. So you'll have systemic reconstitution with human cells. So in the recent study that we published, we made sure we had all the parameters just right to make a model system where the mouse would be reconstituted with macrophages, but not T cells. We have a different model where we can reconstitute with T cells and not macrophages. And then we have several models where we have T cells, macrophages, and a host of other immune cells. So you can kind of pick and choose your model to answer the types of questions that you want.
This sounds like a little bit like the Star Wars of genetic and research, which is exciting to be on the cutting edge, as I'm sure all my friends had seen Star Wars, and I hadn't recently, the most recent one. But I guess in our remaining minute, tell us, you know, this show is entitled The Future of HIV Research, and you're really talking about research that is on the cutting edge, and you're working with these humanized mouses. How far out do you think it is before we are doing this in humans?
I think it's very difficult to predict how quickly we'll be able to translate the laboratory results into clinical applications. But what I have to say is that these models serve a very important purpose. Mice themselves are not susceptible to infection. So by putting in human targets, we have a bridge that could go directly from test tubes into these type of models before they go into humans. And whereas they're not perfect by any stretch of the imagination, I think they're very informative. And they can tell us when things actually work or when things actually don't work. And we can make better choices about what to move into the clinic with minimal risk to humans.
Still such amazing research that's come out of the University of North Carolina. If you both could leave our listeners with just one thing today, what would it be?
I think there's great hope that we will be able to help our patients not only live normal lives, but hopefully in the not-too-distant future, an HIV-free life.
So I would agree with that sentiment, and I think it'll just be important that the HIV researchers kind of don't lose heart. So now that we do have pretty well-tolerated treatments and everything's becoming a lot more affordable and well-tolerated, to make sure that you kind of keep that same drive and push through till we can get to that cure stage.
Well, I know that would be a lasting blessing to all of the millions of people who have been infected, those who've died, like in my family and so many other families around the world. And we thank you so much for doing the research that you are doing to help achieve that vision.
Thank you for having us.
We've been talking with Dr. Victor Garcia and Dr. Jenna Honeycutt, professor of medicine, postdoctoral researcher at the Center for AIDS Research in the University of North Carolina School of Medicine, about the cutting edge of HIV research. Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Catherine Koh. We'll be right back.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Your Health. For our House Call segment, we'll be listening and talking with you about your health questions and concerns.
And if a listener has a question they'd like us to address on an upcoming show, Carol, they can send their comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. And we'd like to ask our executive producer, Daniel Lane, to read us our very first House Call question today.
My father-in-law is almost 90, and he's from Italy. He moved here about 10 years ago, and he never really learned English that well. He complains that his memory is getting worse, but we've never really seen any evidence of that. Is this just depression?
Well, Carol, I bet you see and had seen this at different points in time with all the different people that you see in different roles and your previous role in counseling, and particularly in an immigrant community.
Right. And interesting that you would associate it with depression, which often it can be memory loss or even feeling that you are losing because you're not as sharp as you perceive yourself to be.
Yeah. And I think in this particular case, this is one of the things that it is really good to take your father or mother or loved one in to see your family doctor, your primary care physician. They can do some testing for dementia. They can do some testing for depression. They could help differentiate those two. I bet regardless, even if there's not depression or dementia, there's some validation of feelings and loss that is going on from moving when one's older. It's stressful enough to move when one's younger, much less moving when one's older to a new culture,
to a whole different
new language.
Culture, a new language. I mean, there's so much that could be involved in this.
And even getting a social worker involved to help provide counseling and options and activities that may. I was at a recent senior center, Carol, and I came across a large Asian community of immigrants there, and the senior center had so many great programs, and there was such joy going on in the senior center and support. I could see this person really thriving in a situation in which they no longer feel alone, but perhaps surrounded by others who can help them.
Yep, exactly. I think dealing with the isolation is really important there.
Daniel, what's our next house call?
I'm a 63-year-old woman, and I need a well woman physical. What kinds of issues should I talk about with my doctor?
Well, this is a great question, one that we probably could even do a whole show on. And I think we can do it from a couple different perspectives. I can say some things from a provider perspective. Carol, you might have things that you have seen both from provider-patient perspectives. What sort of things first kind of come up to mind, Carol, in terms of how you kind of think about when you see people and they're worried about and want to make sure that their health is optimal when as they reach that age?
Well, you're thinking at this point in your life, in your 60s, you're getting closer to retirement perhaps, changing lifestyles. Our bodies, I think they start about age 40, start breaking down. But I think as you get closer, you know, you're thinking about not end-of-life issues, but how do I age well? What can I do to keep my health, to keep the health that I have, to improve the health that I have, and to continue to be able to have a good quality of life?
Yeah, I think you're spot on there, Carol. Something like bone health, for instance,
mm-hmm.
whether or not
bone
one
density.
Needs to have a screening for bone density for osteoporosis depends on lots of factors, and that's something to talk about with your mm-hmm. doctor, physical activity and weight mm-hmm. and looking at your blood pressure. When was your last pap smear would be a question I would always ask. Mm-hmm. We'd be talking
and
about –
And you don't think about pap smear at this age, but yes, it's still recommended.
Right. Cervical cancer happens the most often as people age.
Mm-hmm.
Things like mammography would
recently.
Be there. And then probably, you know, one of the biggest things would be your overall number one risk factor for dying at that age, mm-hmm. which would be actually heart disease. Mm-hmm. And so really thinking about what is your risk of heart disease and would you benefit from medications or other lifestyle interventions. So this is just a good start, but I really like your idea, Carol, of suggesting just talking about aging, and that it could be at any age, but at this age of some transitions in mm-hmm. life, that's a great idea.
Yeah.
Daniel, what's our last house call?
My one-year-old has had a face rash. It's got redness with rough places, and we thought it was due to the cold, but with spring weather, it hasn't really improved. We've been using a natural salve because we didn't want to use a petroleum-based Vaseline that our doctor recommended, but what do you think?
Well, this is a great question, and my first answer is send me a picture.
Always.
You know, Carol has heard me in the clinic lots of times when she says, what do you think about this? I say, well, it's a rash. Let's have a picture, because a picture is worth not a thousand words, but it's worth a lot of words mm-hmm. here. And, you know, I think, you know, what sort of
when
things,
somebody's
Carol,
that
just
young, is it? Could it be a food allergy?
Yeah, well, you know, it's interesting. I oftentimes say when someone comes in and sees a doctor and they're given a diagnosis on a skin condition, it's one of three possibilities if it doesn't get better immediately. Either it was the wrong diagnosis, mm-hmm. and so that's always possible. But sometimes it could be the right diagnosis and the wrong treatment, mm-hmm. or it can be the right diagnosis and the right treatment but not the right dose. So sometimes you need a fairly potent, for instance, anti-inflammatory agent. The doctor may have recommended very very minimally potent, like hydrocortisone cream, and you needed something like a much more potent topical steroid, or they recommended a fungal agent, you really needed a topical steroid, or they got the diagnosis wrong. In this case, it sounds like it probably could have been the right diagnosis, which we would call eczema, mm-hmm. or the really dry skin, atopic dermatitis on a one-year-old. But what happens is that skin sometimes gets to be kind of really abnormal, and sometimes the topical things that one can do like Vaseline, which some people, particularly on the child's face, may not be cosmetically very acceptable, don't work so well. And you really need an anti-inflammatory, oftentimes a prescription agent for a small period of time to get that skin back to normal so then the natural medicines mm-hmm. could maybe work better. So
are steroids okay for one-year-olds?
You could use a topical over-the-counter 1% hydrocortisone for a couple weeks. You might need something a little bit stronger. This is something you would do with your provider. Mm-hmm. A dermatologist, primary care physician, and then following to make sure it does get better. There could be some other things going on, but that's probably a starting place. Good skin care would be a starting place, and particularly as the winter goes on, maybe it's less of a problem as we move into the spring, summer. So that'll conclude our house calls today, and we want to thank all of you for joining us for Your Health. We hope we've addressed issues and concerns that are important, and you can send us your own questions at yourhealth@unc.edu. Visit online at yourhealthradio.org or follow us on Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, or use our health app.
We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine and UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship. It's been good to be with you today, Adam, as co-host and our special guest,
Dr. Victor Garcia and Dr. Jenna Honeycutt. We hope you'll join us again next time on Your Health. On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein, and we want to thank you all for listening to us today. Thank you so much, and we look forward to seeing you again next week. Bye-bye.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine.